Eleanor Roosevelt once said that she believed we focus so much on the aggressive sins, the sins that, such as criminal activity, murder, those aggressive sins that really seem to bother us more than those others. She said we focus on those too much, and the problem with that is we seem to neglect those sins that are less aggressive, like indifference, apathy, laziness. She said, and yet it's those sins that over a long term can have the most devastating effect. You know, you think about indifference, which is our topic for tonight. A lack of care and concern sometimes that can settle in within each of us, within our brethren, and can, it's almost that silent killer. Have you ever had something to dry rot? Maybe the first thing I think of is like a trailer. Let's say you go out one evening, or maybe it's early one morning. You hadn't pulled that fishing boat out in a long time. It's been in the garage, and you go in there. Maybe it's just been sitting out. You go out there, and you take the tarp off, uncover it. You're getting ready to go, and as you begin to roll out, the tires just tear apart. And come to find out, they've dry rotted. You know, someone once called indifference the dry rot of the soul. Maybe an even better example is carbon monoxide. That, speaking of a silent killer, you know, there's no order, there's no odor, there's no sound. You just breathe that in and you don't even know you're doing it. And before you know it, you become tired. You end up falling asleep and you never wake up again. In fact, recently, I guess it was last year, a friend of Amber's, or at least someone that she went to school with, was pressure washing in his garage. And he was breathing that stuff in. And the next day they found him and his life had been taken from him. That's what indifference is. It's just a silent killer. You're being indifferent and you're breathing this in and going to sleep and you don't even realize it. Just like these dry riding tires, you don't realize it until it's over and you're spiritually dead. There's a phrase in the Bible that comes up from time to time, and it's not always worded exactly like this. The first example it is, and so it's become the title of this lesson. But the phrase is, "and they sat down." There are occasions, and we see this several times. I'm going to point out about three of them, time permitting tonight. But there are occasions when you see that phrase, when something terrible is going on and people just sit down and act like nothing's wrong. That's this idea of indifference. Let's go to Genesis 37 and see the first example of this. Genesis chapter 37. We're talking about indifference. Genesis chapter 37. And as you're turning there, before we get to verse 25 or so, I want you to remember the context, what's taking place here. Jacob has 11 sons. Joseph has been born. Remember, Benjamin is not there just yet. And Joseph is the favorite. He's getting preferential treatment, favoritism from his father Jacob. And it's causing a lot of problems. We might even say they are a dysfunctional family in modern terms because of this. And the Bible says, in fact, let's look at it. Genesis 37, look at verse number 3. Now Israel, that is of course Jacob, loved Joseph more than all his children. Very clear about that. More than all his children, because he was the son of his old age. And he made him a coat of many colors. And when his brethren saw, this is verse 4, their father loved him more than all his brethren. Notice, they didn't just dislike him. They didn't just, you know, they weren't just a little envious of him. They hated him. Very strong language. And could not speak peaceably unto him. Joseph dreamed a dream and he told his brethren, and they hated him yet the more. This was a rough situation. Now, while we can't certainly justify or say that there can be no blame for some of the decisions they're about to make, you could see to begin with why there would be some envy. Jacob here is being very preferential towards Joseph. You know, that coat of many colors, as I was looking into this, that was very symbolic. That was given to the one who would oversee. In other words, what was happening here is Jacob was entrusting Joseph to be the one to overlook or to have the oversight over the rest of his brothers, to make sure that they're getting the job done out in the fields that they ought to have. I want you to imagine for a moment, many of you have siblings. Some of you maybe have younger siblings. Could you imagine if one day, especially when you were younger, let's say you were a teenager or a young adult and you've got a younger sibling and your mom or dad just decided that that they were going to put that younger sibling in charge of you? How would that make you feel? Right? How do they have the authority? How do they have the experience and the wisdom to decide what I need to do? I have a little sister that's been adopted into my family, and she is given. There's a very large age difference. I'm not trying to make myself sound too old, but there's probably, 15 years, I guess, difference between us given. But I just cannot fathom, think about Reuben down to Joseph. There's a span there. I can't imagine my mother saying to me, Chloe, your little sister, she's going to be over you. She's going to make sure you do your job right. So we can see these brothers would be a little bit envious. What's going on here? I don't understand. I'm not going to listen to him. And so they don't have any respect for their father's decision or for Joseph. And Joseph does something that we would probably say is not the wisest decision. He has a couple of dreams. And in those dreams, basically what it comes down to is that his brothers are going to bow to him based on these dreams. And he tells them. And that, the Bible says then he hated them even more after he tells them of these dreams. Things are not going well. Well, look down. Let's jump down to verse number 18. Joseph has to go out. Now, again, he's the one that's been placed in charge of this. And so Jacob sends Joseph to go find your brothers. They're not where they're supposed to be. Joseph, go take care of business here. Go see where they're at. Correct this. And he finally, after talking to someone else, he finally finds them. And when they see him, verse 18, afar off, even before he came near unto them, they conspired against him to slay him. They're already making this conscious decision in their hatred. So much they hate him that they're going to take his life. Verse 19, they said one to another, behold, this dreamer cometh. There's their attitude. This dreamer. Here he comes. And so you see in verse 20, they have this plan. We're going to say that some evil beast came up and took his life. We'll dip his coat in blood. And that's basically what they end up doing. But Reuben, as you recall, in verse 21 says, let's not kill him, okay? But let's throw him into a pit. And it's very, the language is interesting here. If you look at verse number 24, they took him and cast him into a pit, and the pit was empty. There was no water in it. The way the language is it really in a few verses prior to it, suggests that they didn't care. They just threw him in this pit, and come to find out, thankfully for Joseph, there was no water in this pit. Okay, it was dry, just so happens. And you know how this story unfolds. But the next thing that happens is in verse 25. And they sat down to eat bread. That's the key phrase here. This is the indifference. They have just thrown their youngest brother into a pit, not even really knowing what's going to happen. Keep in mind, Judah has not spoken up yet. Judah's going to speak up and say, why don't we sell him when this band of people comes by? But at this point, that's not happened. They've thrown him into a pit. They're going to lie to their father and never have anything to do with their brother again. Who knows if he'll even live? And they're just going to sit down and have a meal and act like nothing's wrong. That is indifference. That's what we're talking about. Now, someone might say, how in the world could they be so indifferent towards their brother? But as we make application of this, how different really are we when we are sometimes indifferent towards our brethren? Now, don't misunderstand me. I'm not suggesting that any of you is so indifferent or hate your brethren so much that you are plotting to their murder. I hope not. If you're doing that with me, let me know and let's work this out. I think we'd all feel, I know that's not the case. But on a lighter application of this, that sometimes we can be indifferent towards our brethren and not even, think about we think of Joseph as that youngest. Think of the youngest member of the body here, maybe not necessarily youngest in age, but youngest in spiritual maturity, maybe that weaker brother. How do you feel towards he or she? How do you feel about your brethren? Do you really care about how they're doing throughout the week? How often are you checking on them? How often are you visiting them when they're in the hospital, or at least calling? And how often do you maybe send a card, however it is that you like to let them know that you care? Are you at that funeral when someone has lost lost a loved one, whoever that member might be? The list could go on and on. We can be indifferent towards them. I think of 1 John 3 and verse 17, where John says, "Whoso sees his," or rather, he starts out this way, "Who hath this world's good and sees his brother have need, and shutteth up his bowels of compassion toward him? How dwelleth the love of the Father in him?" How can you, how can I, having the good of this world, see that weaker brother in need and just be indifferent towards him or her and not care for them and at least do something to try to encourage them? I remember a story about an older doctor who was spiritually minded, and he had he was talking about love. And basically the younger doctor asked him, you know, what is the greatest, and he was thinking more about literal medicine here, but what's the greatest medicine that we can give someone? You know, what would you prescribe the most? What's like that medicine that you always fall back on? You know, and he says, to his surprise, the older doctor says, well, that's love. That's love. And he says, well, I'm thinking of his schooling, you know, he says, well, what if that dosage doesn't work? What if love is not the right prescription? To which the older doctor replied, then double the dosage. Love, that kindness we've been talking about, the theme for the entirety of this year is what we need more of. We need more of that love for one another. And to show our brethren and the world around us, we'll get to that in a moment, that we're not indifferent, that we do care, that we're concerned about them. 1 Corinthians that you see on the screen there, 12, 24 and 25, Paul talks about the body. Verse 25 in particular, that there be no schisms in the body and that the members have the same care and concern one for another. How many of you, well, don't raise your hands here, but many of you may be like me in this regard. There's not too many times that I'm hammering a nail that I don't miss that nail and hit another nail. You know what I'm talking about? I want you to think about for a moment what you do when that happens. Maybe you don't. Maybe I'm the clumsy one here, but I'll miss that and I'll hit my thumb. And I was thinking about this and what I would do. And sometimes our reaction is different, but you know, maybe you wave your hand a bit, but for me, I'm usually taking this hand when I feel that pain and I wrap it around that thumb and maybe grip my teeth and apply pressure. You know, what am I doing? I'm trying to comfort that pain. And in fact, my whole body, sometimes I'm not a very manly man, let's be honest. My whole body may bend over in pain and I may say ow or whatever. I may throw the hammer across the room. But your body, you get what I'm saying. Your whole body reacts to that. It's just a thumb, but man, it hurts. We need to be, you get what I'm saying, we need to be that hand, brethren, that reaches out and holds on to them, that grabs them and takes care of them, and view them as being you say, well, that's just a thumb, right? That's not a hand, that's not the eye, that's not the tongue which we speak with, but you and I both know how important even that thumb is. And we know when it hurts, especially when we hit it with a hammer. I'm thinking about it, just talking about it, like it just happened. Ladies, listen now. Football season's almost over, okay? You're going to get your husbands back soon, but I'm kidding. But football has some great illustrations from this idea of team. And we could choose any sport, but this one in particular I'm choosing because for a long time, football teams really didn't put a lot of stock into the kicker. They didn't really care about the kicker of the football team. And ladies, you probably know a little about this, maybe all of it, maybe more than I do, who knows? Some of you may be big into this, but regardless, you understand that, you know, they have these face masks. They would put on the kicker just a face mask with maybe one bar in it. You know, it wasn't a big deal. He's usually a puny guy. He's not big and strong like the linemen that are up there, you know, butting heads all the time and shoulder pads. And he's a little guy, and you look in the Hall of Fame, there's very few kickers. But it didn't take long before these teams began to realize, and studies have shown, in fact, I think it's interesting, that one out of every three football games is won or lost by three or less points. Now, why is that significant? Most of you know why, but if you don't know why, the kicker, when he kicks that field goal from 30 yards out or whatever it is, that's 3 points. It's very important. How many games have you seen, gentlemen, where the football team wins or loses based on whether or not that kicker made that shot? You say, well, he don't ever go out on the field just for a few moments. But still, his role is so very important. Whether you think this person is the kicker or the quarterback of this congregation, it does not matter. They are all equally important. And the congregation can win or lose in its teamwork, spiritually speaking, of course, based on a lack of indifference or a lack of love for that player, for that participant, for that member of the body. You get where we're going with that. Another part of this indifference for the erring. In particular, I don't know that the congregation here struggles in any of these areas. You know, maybe each individual has an area that they could work on more than others. And so keep that in mind, as I'm not talking to a particular person here, but to everyone. as we think about this together, but maybe just erring probably in most congregations would be where we struggle the most. Probably indifference toward them. You know, we have this attitude. Let me say this first before I say that. Galatians 6 and verse 1. Brethren, if a man be overtaken in a fault, you who are, or ye who are spiritual, restore such an one in the spirit of meekness. Okay, in other words, when this ailment happens and they're spiritually sick, you are the doctor, if you will, the one that needs to correct this, to heal them. Literally, the word restore means to take a bone, a broken bone, and to put it back in place. That sounds painful. But in other words, this is serious. Paul's getting at here, the word he chooses. This is serious. And unlike an actual broken leg or arm where the person's going to call the doctor and make that appointment, in this case, that's probably not going to happen. Person that's erring probably isn't going to call and say, listen, I'm hurting and I need your help. Maybe, but in most cases not. We've got to be the ones to go to them. Paul's telling us, you who are spiritual, you need to get out there. Don't be indifferent towards those who are erring. You need to go to them and help them put that bone back in place. Help them heal. Otherwise, they're not going to heal properly, right? Here's what I was going to say before. Sometimes we have this Mary as the nursery rhyme, I guess it is, goes. And wasn't it Mary that taught, or Little Bo Peep, not Mary, Little Bo Peep. It's been a while, okay? I don't have kids. I'm not into the nursery rhymes anymore. Little Bo Peep has lost her sheep and doesn't know where to find them. How does it go? They will leave them alone and they'll come home wagging their tails. Thank you, wagging their tails behind them. That's it. That's the attitude we sometimes have about it. Just leave them alone, they'll come back. But keep in mind, Little Bo Peep is not our shepherd. Jesus is our shepherd. And his mentality, in fact, we just sang a great song, Larry, that you just led. That's just it. Bring them in. Go and get them and bring them back. I want that one sheep that's been lost to come back to the 99. The angels are more excited about that. Right? That's the shepherd we serve. Go to them and bring them in. Don't be that like that towards the erring. John 13, speaking, I mentioned love earlier. We'll just mention this text where Jesus says, a new commandment I give unto you, that ye love one another as I have loved you, that ye also love one another. By this shall all men know that ye are my disciples, if ye have love for one another. That's one, I forget the name. I'll just say it's been said. I had the name in my head earlier, but I want to give credit where credit is due. I can't remember the person that quoted it now, but talking about the last apologetic that we have is love. The last evidence we have as brethren to convince our brethren and even those in the world around us that we are true Christians is that love, is that loving kindness, is putting that in motion. That's what Jesus says. By this, they'll know you're my disciples. By what, Jesus? By loving them the way that I've loved you. If we're indifferent, that's the opposite. Indifference is the opposite of caring and loving them. Don't do anything to show them that you care, and you're doing the opposite of what Jesus said. And I need to hear that as much as anybody in here, no doubt. Always preaching to myself as well. Let's go to Esther. Esther chapter 3, and look at another example. Esther chapter 3. I've referenced Esther a few times. Esther is a book that's full of so many great lessons, as so many of the books are. And no doubt I'll mention Esther a few more times in the future. But in Esther chapter 3, we have this situation with Haman again. And I'll remind you, Haman, in this particular case, Haman is upset because the king has made a decree that everyone bow down and give reverence to Haman. That's Haman's loving this. Everybody's bowing down to him, but there's one guy who they notice doesn't bow down, and that's Mordecai, as you recall. Mordecai does not bow down, and he gets evidence of this in that he goes and sees for himself. I want you to notice something with me. Before I continue, I want you to look at verse 1. Esther 3, verses 1, and then we're going to tie it in with verse 13 in a moment. But read verse 1. After these things, did King Ahasuerus promote Haman, the son of Hammedatha, here's the word I want you to key on, the Agagite, and advanced him and set his seat above all the princes that were with him. This is leading into the fact that they've got to bow to him. Agagite. Do you recognize that term? Who was Agag? If you recall, you go back to 1 Samuel 15, Agag and his people, the Amalekites, were the ones that Saul was told by God to utterly destroy. destroy every one of them. There should be no Agagites left. However, there is one who was spared. Well, he decided he was going to spare Agag, that he would later sacrifice him. And you notice here, I think this is very significant. You notice here that there's a consequence of that. Because Saul deterred from what God asked him to do, there's going to be punishment here, a consequence here, rather I should say, that comes from this. They're having to deal with Haman, who, guess what, is a descendant in some shape, form, or fashion of Agag. He should have never even been on the planet, but here he is, and God's people are suffering because of it. And just on a side note, that's another reason why sin is so selfish, because not only will we have consequences, but a lot of times others are going to suffer consequences for that sin as well. But we notice, nonetheless, that Mordecai, verse 5, he sees it firsthand. Mordecai is not bowing down to him. And so he goes to the king. King Ahasuerus, listen, I need you to wipe out. The people are against you. I need you to make a decree to kill them all. Not just Mordecai. I want you to take out every one of the Jews. And he says, I'll give you 10,000 shekels of silver if you'll do this. I guess he was planning to gather up all the money from these Jews. I don't know if he really was going to pay that, if he just thought, if he was maybe trying to bribe the king, but that's what he offers nonetheless. And the king adheres to that, and he makes his decree. And look at verse 13. This is what I was getting at in connection to verse 1. The letters were sent by the post to all the king's provinces. Here's the decree. To destroy, notice this, to kill, to cause to perish, all Jews, both young and old, little children and women, in one day, even upon the 13th day of the 12th month, which is the month of Adar, and to take the spoil of them for a prey. Does that sound familiar? Haman has convinced the king to do exactly what Saul was supposed to do to the Amalekites many years ago. 1 Samuel chapter 15. What's going on here? Well, now Haman has got this king to say, you know what? I want you to take out every one of the Jews, even the little ones, even the women. I want all of them dead. And that's exactly what the king decrees. But look at verse 15. Here's the point. Verse 15. The post went out, being as hastened by the king's commandment. The decree was given in Shushan the palace. And the king and Haman, don't miss it, sat down to drink. But the city Shushan was perplexed. I just can't imagine it. I cannot imagine being able to just sit down and have a drink together, having just issued a death warrant for entire people that are there. No telling how many that would have been involved at this point and whose lives were about to be taken, and they're indifferent towards it. Where are you going with this, preacher? Well, here's the point. Here's the application. We don't even sometimes look at it this way, and I really think that I'm talking about evangelism now. I really think when it comes to evangelism, one of the issues, myself included, is looking at it the right way and just realizing what's really going on. We've got to realize that there's a decree, in a sense, given to all the people in this world that are not a child of God. They've been warned that they're going to be lost for eternity. We're not just talking about death. We're talking about spiritual death. When we read that, I don't know about you, but I want to fix that. I don't want all those Jews to die. That's awful. I definitely don't want all these people to be lost. Maybe if we look at it that way, and instead of being just indifferent towards them and recognize, like Jesus says in Matthew 7, there's a straight and narrow path, and there's a broad path. And if we realize that when we're out in this world, that we're on this narrow path, and these people are on a broad one, and we need to get them and bring them over and get them on the path that we're on. We need them to be here so that they don't go to that utter destruction. But when we're indifferent, we don't really make any effort to teach our neighbor, to teach those that we're coming in contact with at our work, young people at school, on the football team, if you're playing sports, or tennis, golf, band, whatever it is. If we're not taking the advantage of those opportunities, are we any better than them? Sitting down and enjoying a meal and not even realizing. No, don't get me wrong, it's not that you can't sit down and eat, but doing so and not really even recognizing that these people around us need us so much, and I'm not even making that effort that I should. You know, I was reading recently that I don't remember again all these names. I'm horrible with names, as you can tell, but I want to give credit here. But another gentleman made this statement. He was writing some literature on this, And according to him, if you were to take the nation, just America, just our nation, and turn the unchurched, I'm not even people in the denominational world, those that are not involved in churches anywhere, denominations anywhere, I should say, if you were to take just them and make them a nation, they would be the fifth largest nation in the world. He goes on to say that the United States is the third largest mission field in the world. Here's the point. We don't have to go overseas in order to do some mission work. Right? And in fact, the elders were telling me when I first got here that the congregation, I guess it was a few years back, went to North Carolina, something to that effect, and in this very nation. And you've been overseas as well, but and did mission work. And that's wonderful. There's a mission field, as Jesus put it, the harvest is wide and the laborers are few right here. But we've got to focus on it. We've got to be aware of what's going on around us and get out there and get to it, as they say. Someone also once said that the great commission has become the great omission. And that's a sad truth in a lot of ways. Paul Harvey, I'm remembering one name. Paul Harvey made the statement that we're not being fishers of men, we're being caretakers for the aquarium. Think about that for a minute. We're concerned only about the aquarium and we're not adding new fish to it. Right? Don't get me wrong, the aquarium's important. We need to be focusing on the church, the body as well, but we're just not bringing more fish in. All right, we're not being fishers of men. We're not evangelizing the gospel. You know what I'm saying there. I certainly believe. Let's keep going. Oh, I forgot about this. This is an interesting story. I'm fascinated with technology, and I like to pretend that I know a lot about it. I really don't. I'm learning more and more, and then I realize how much I don't know. But the company Apple, here we go, names again, Steve Jobs and Steve Wozniak, I believe is how you pronounce it. When these guys, they were just computer geeks that decided they were going to start this company, Apple. And they were very good at what they did. They knew all about these computers, but they had no marketing skills whatsoever. And they needed somebody to market this business. And so they went to John Sculley, the founder of PepsiCo. And you know how well PepsiCo is doing and has been doing for a long time. And they go to John and they say, listen, we need you. We want you to market for our product. No way, not going to happen. And they come to him a second time. No way, not going to happen. They come to him a third time and they give him a pitch that he could not resist. This is what they said to him. They said, you can spend your time continuing to sell sugared water, I believe is how they put it. Selling sugared water. Or do you want to have an opportunity to change the world? And when they pitched that to him, he, of course, marked it. And now Apple, you could argue, in their own way, has really changed the world, the world of technology. That pitch, I say that to say this. Jesus has given us that, I don't know if I want to call it a pitch, but he's given us that command. He's given us that desire, hopefully, that will be instilled within us to want to change the world. We can do that. That's not just preacher talk. We can do that. We can change the world, and he's given us the power to do it. And if we really believe in that power, if we really do, we'll take it and let it speak for itself and just show them what it says. Worst thing to do is say no, right? Whatever the consequences are, I know that you're willing. Deep down, and I am too, we're willing to suffer whatever consequences there are, but the outcome is just too good not to. It's too important, and we should want to do that. One last one, Matthew chapter 27. Matthew chapter 27. I want to bring you to the cross one final time today. Indifference. And this is really just kind of a summation. I'll just take just a moment here. But Matthew 27, we're going to begin in verse 34 in a moment. This is right after they have scourged our Lord. He's bore his cross. He's now nailed with pierced hands and feet to the cross. And this is what's taking place down below him. You can almost, I want you to look from Jesus' point of view in a panoramic scene here. As he's looking down, this is what he's seeing. Look at verse 34. They gave him vinegar to drink, mingled with gall, and when he had tasted, he would not drink. Verse 35. They crucified him and parted his garments, casting lots. They're gambling for his clothes, that it might be fulfilled which was spoken by the prophet. They parted my garments among them, and upon my vesture did they cast lots. And sitting down, they watched him there. Again, I just can't fathom it. They're sitting there watching this man who, with the torn back that he has, is having to force himself up to breathe, and then he's got to move the tension from his hands down to his feet, and you know how that process worked, and he's rubbing his back, and they're just watching. It's just a job. It's just what Caesar told me to do. I'm just doing my job. And they take that, and they sit there, and they're just watching as if nothing. That's indifference. But again, how are we different, really, from them? I know, don't misunderstand me. I know there's some differences. But as we make application of this, how are we really different when it comes to being indifferent about the things that he died on the cross to save, the things on that he died on the cross to purchase? Acts 20 and verse 28, he purchased what? The church with his own blood, right? If I'm indifferent towards the church, right, I might as well just be sitting there at the bottom of the cross. Because that's why he was there. That's why he was dying. Do I not really care about why he died? That's what he died for, the church. What about the New Testament? Matthew 26, 28. He died on the cross. He said, this is the blood of the new covenant. Why are we indifferent towards that book? I know, in a congregation of this amount of people right now, I know there's just the chances are very little that everyone in this congregation opened their Bible every day this week and studied it. It's just the world that we live in. Even in the Lord's body, it just we get busy. I understand. We get busy and we forget. But some of us maybe are just only opening it on Sunday. I hope not. Maybe just on Sunday and Wednesday when we're here and that's it. Right? Again, if I'm indifferent towards the New Testament that His body was shed to put in place, how am I any better than those guys just sitting at the bottom of the cross? Playing and gambling. I'm just playing church, basically, right? I'm just here, going through the motions, and I'm really just indifferent. I'm not really concerned. But think about it. Think about the prayers. Could you tell me, and I don't misunderstand, I'm not trying to be mean to you, but could you tell me what was said in that opening prayer a few moments ago? Do you recall some of those things? Or were you thinking about other stuff? Were you thinking about what's going on next week? Even right now, are you even listening to me? I think you are. You're looking at me. I think you are. But it's just so easy to just say, you know what, this is, I do this all the time, this is every week, I've got other things to worry about, and just breathe in that carbon monoxide, spiritually speaking. That's, if Satan can get you, you're not going to murder anybody, I know that. There's not a person in this congregation that's going to murder somebody. You're not going to do that. But if Satan's going to get you, he's going to get you with something like indifference, something like apathy. It's so easy to do, and it's so easy to just let it spread throughout the congregation. Let me conclude with Lamentations chapter 1 and verse 12. Lamentations 1 and verse 12. Philippians 3:18 is a great passage to mark that one down as well. But let's conclude. Lamentations 1 and verse 12. Matter of fact, let's turn to it. I skipped a passage, so let's turn to this one together. Jeremiah is probably easier to find, and it's going to be one book over. 52 chapters in Jeremiah. Go to Lamentations 1 and I just want you to notice the first question in Lamentations 1 and verse 12. And the lesson will be yours. Lamentations 1:12. He writes, "Is it nothing to you, all ye that pass by?" I mean, that literally is the question of this entire lesson. Is it nothing to you? Is it nothing to me as we pass by in a sense? When you think about the Lord's body, you think about the brethren, those that are weak, those that maybe are erring, and you think about the love that we're to have and the world around us that's in sin, the things that Jesus died to make sure were meaningful, that they had a place, the church and the saved and the New Testament, all of those things. Is it nothing to you? Friends, if you're here tonight and indifference is a problem in your life, I just want to encourage you. We all want to encourage you to care, to be concerned. Don't let Satan do that to you. It's very, very simple to fall into to that rut, to just begin dry rotting and not even realize that's what you're doing. Maybe you're recognizing it tonight, and maybe it's a private nature and you want to keep it that way, but pray about that and work on that. Work on your heart and open that book every day. And I assure you, if you're studying that book every day, you're not apathetic to the Lord and His work. That's really where it all begins. If you're not studying that Bible, do it. And together, we're going to grow if we do that as a congregation. I love you and I want to encourage you, if you're subject to the Lord's invitation, maybe it is that you've not become a child of God. Maybe you've been indifferent about your salvation. I mean, Satan would love to just have you not even care whether you're a Christian or not. Or better yet, maybe to make you think you are when you're not. Right? Paul says, prove all things. Can you prove with this book that you're a child of God? Are you ready to stand before God at judgment and say, I know that I'm saved because I did what this book says? Have you believed that Jesus is the Son of God, repented of sin, confessed His name, and been baptized in water for the remission of sins? If you've done it for those reasons, been baptized for the remission of your sins with those prerequisites, then yes, you can be confident because that's what the Word of God teaches. Maybe it is you've done those things and sin has come back into your life. It's probably not the sin of murder, but it very well may be the sin of indifference. If there's something else, whatever it might be, make it right. We love you, and if we can encourage you, pray with you, encourage you in any way, come forward right now as we stand and sing together.